From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today is not only Inauguration Day, but Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. We talked to his youngest daughter, Reverend Bernice King, and the governor and a state legislator from New Hampshire, which still refuses to make Dr. King's birthday a holiday.
The KKK actually came on the steps of the State House and congratulated the State House on not passing the day.
Also, highlights of the Ethics Committee's hearings into violations committed by House Speaker Newt Gingrich.
Today is a sad day. A member has admitted violating the ethics rules of our House and bringing discredit on the House of Representatives. This process and this admission affects not only that member, but affects each of us who serve in this body. While I believe this is true in any ethics proceedings, it's particularly true and particularly troublesome in this case because the offending member is the Speaker of the House, the third-ranking official in our government.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton's second inauguration will cost more than $42 million. Most of the expenses, $30 million, is being spent by the private Presidential Inaugural Committee. The committee is covering the cost of entertainment on the National Mall, the 14 official balls, and the presidential gala. The committee gets its money from the sale of tickets to the balls and gala, plus souvenir sales and the television rights to the gala. The federal government is chipping in $11.7 million, while Congress is spending almost $1 million for the inaugural platform and luncheon. Meanwhile, today at noon Eastern Standard Time, anti-hunger, welfare, and homeless advocates are holding an outdoor soup kitchen and speak out during President Clinton's inaugural speech. Serving soup is a metaphor for those affected by passage of the Personal Responsibility Act and cuts to housing and aid to the homeless programs. An anti-abortion group said yesterday it had won a federal court order allowing it to demonstrate during today's inaugural parade. The Interior Department's Park Service had denied a permit for the Christian Defense Coalition to demonstrate along the parade route and to display pictures of aborted children. But the coalition said a three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington approved an emergency motion that will allow its members to demonstrate in groups of 25 or fewer as long as they don't interfere with anyone demonstrating in support of President Clinton. Meanwhile, FBI agents are taking over the investigation of a pair of bombings at a Tulsa, Oklahoma women's health clinic that performs abortions. The Oklahoma incident comes just days after several people were injured when a pair of bombings rocked an abortion clinic in Atlanta. Federal investigators say that as a matter of routine, they're looking into whether there's any connection between the bombings. An international trade union leader brushing aside threats of deportation said today South Korea's industrial crisis undermined the country's image and that its reputation is at stake over a new labor law. Meanwhile, in a dramatic climb down, South Korean President Kim Yong-sam today agreed to meet opposition leaders to resolve a crisis over that new labor law that ignited more than 3 weeks of strikes. Japan is launching its biggest spy agency today, a unified military group ending decades of fragmented intelligence gathering and reliance on information from Washington. Northern Ireland police today report two explosions at a police station in Belfast. The blasts were at the Mount Pottinger police station in the Short Strand area of the city. In Mexico, Acapulco, six prisoners accused of belonging to a rebel army in the southern Mexico state of Guerrero have joined a widening hunger strike to press for their release. The six peasants seized in the immediate aftermath of the appearance of the so-called Popular Revolutionary Army, or EPR, June 28th, said they're joining 12 accused EPR prisoners held in the neighboring state of Oaxaca in the protest fast. A federal task force investigating a wave of arson fires at American churches reported Saturday that racism is a factor in many of the blazes, but that there is no evidence of a broad conspiracy. President Clinton last June created the National Church Arson Task Force to coordinate federal, state, and local efforts after black religious leaders voiced concern about the increasing attacks on black churches in the South. The task force reported that of 328 cases of arson or bombings against churches in 95 and 96, 138 attacks were directed at African-American congregations. Madeleine Albright is moving closer to becoming the country's first female Secretary of State. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee meets this morning and is expected to recommend Albright's confirmation. And finally, Senator Paul Tsongas, who died Saturday after fighting pneumonia and complications associated with cancer, will be buried in his hometown of Lowell, Massachusetts on Thursday, this according to a funeral home spokesperson. The Tsongas family will hold a wake in their home in his memory Tuesday and Wednesday, and services will be held at a Greek Orthodox church on Thursday. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Today is Martin Luther King Day, a day of reflection and remembrance of the struggle for equal rights and the man who led the movement that changed America. One state, however, still refuses to officially recognize the third Monday in January as a holiday, and it's New Hampshire. But this year, things might change. A statewide grassroots movement has brought new pressure on the Republican-controlled legislature, and a newly elected Democratic governor of New Hampshire, the first woman elected to the post, has promised to push for a Martin Luther King Day. I spoke to Governor Jeanne Shaheen yesterday at an Emily's List luncheon. It was a celebratory luncheon for the inauguration today, and I asked her about the controversy. Governor Shaheen, a quick question for you. What are you going to do about the fact that New Hampshire is the only state in the country that doesn't recognize Martin Luther King's birthday?
Well, I'm certainly doing everything I can. I signed an executive order to make Monday Martin Luther King's Civil Rights Day. I'm supporting the legislation that's been introduced to recognize Martin Luther King as part of the holiday. I think New Hampshire needs to join the 49 other states because New Hampshire has been a state that's traditionally opened doors for people. I think we should recognize that recognizing Martin Luther King as part of the holiday is critical in order to send that message to the rest of the country.
What has stopped it in New Hampshire?
I think it's opposition from various groups in the legislature, far-right groups.
Do you think in this year it might become an official holiday?
I certainly hope so. I'm doing everything I can to make that happen.
That's New Hampshire Governor Jeanne Shaheen. I also got a chance to speak with Jackie Weatherspoon, a newly elected New Hampshire state legislator. She's only one of three African-American representatives in the 440-member legislature. She was elected to represent Exeter, New Hampshire last November on a platform of recognizing Martin Luther King's birthday.
Well, it's been on a number of fronts. First of all, it has, again, has tried to get passed 10 years. It's passed in the state Senate. However, it has now not passed in the House. And the last time it was attempted, 2 years ago, it did not pass by 64 votes.
What's the rationale?
The rationale is that there are a number, first of all, what they did pass in 1994 was what they call Civil Rights Day. And the rationale for New Hampshire, the House, was there have been more than one people or peoples that have done or have achieved incredible odds for change in America, and that Martin Luther King should not receive all of that glory. They have also said that they didn't feel that Martin Luther King was someone that they wanted to have embodied with that holiday. In the last time that it was presented, the KKK actually came on the steps of the statehouse and congratulated the statehouse on not passing the day.
And that was when Steve Merrill was governor,
that was
is that
Steve
right?
Merrill.
Steve Merrill, who was the co-chair of the Dole campaign.
Yes. He decided on that day 2 years ago to do a proclamation for the day, which is not the same thing as having a full-fledged Martin Luther King Jr. Civil Rights Day.
Was it also raised in state legislative debates that Martin Luther King was against the Vietnam War?
Against the Vietnam War, that he was a communist, and that he was a womanizer.
And so what do you plan to do in the state legislature?
What we have planned to do, we have bipartisan support, both Republicans in the State House and the Senate, whom we think will give us the over-the-top that we need. Plus, this is the first time in many, many years that we have a Democratic governor, and believe it or not, it's the first time in the history of New Hampshire that we have a woman Democrat governor.
And she is?
Jeanne Shaheen. And part of her campaign platform that she was for a Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Also, New Hampshire has the unfortunate title of being the only state that does not have a kindergarten. So the state is really poised in a number of ways, not only in terms of civil rights, but in looking at families and having the next generation really be prepared and equipped in a smaller, shrinking, global community. So we're excited up here with Jean being our new governor. We will also be, we've gotten a lot of support from students in the state of New Hampshire. Now, as you know, Amy, when adults don't do their job, it has been proven through history that students, young people, always rise up. And we've had some incredible young people in the Seacoast area, up in the Hanover, where Dartmouth University is, in our Nashua area, who have rallied, who have started petitions, who have gone to the State House. We also have students from St. Paul's, Phillips Exeter Academy, who are bringing petitions tomorrow to the State House to present to the governor.
Jackie Witherspoon, do you have a phone number that people can call in New Hampshire, perhaps to speed up the process, to let their views be heard on this subject?
Yes, I can give you that number. That number is 603-271-3661.
Again?
603-271-3661 and ask for the Speaker of the House.
Jackie Witherspoon, thanks very much for joining us. Jackie Witherspoon is a newly elected New Hampshire state legislator continuing that fight to recognize Martin Luther King's birthday. Perhaps the one image that comes to mind of Dr. Martin Luther King's youngest daughter is that of a young 5-year-old laying her head in her mother's lap in the front pew of the Ebenezer Baptist Church during her father's funeral. Some 30 years later, Reverend Bernice King has followed her father's footsteps and joined the ministry. Today, she's an assistant pastor at Greater Rising Star Baptist Church in Atlanta. And she's just written a book called Hard Questions, Hard Answers. We welcome you to Democracy Now, Reverend King. And why don't we start by you telling us how your father influenced your choosing your life's work?
Well, I mean, he has influenced a lot of my thinking and my thoughts and my concerns about the American society and the world community at large. And the book that I've just written, Hard Questions, Hard Answers, is dedicated to him because of that inspiration he has provided. And I lift up a lot of the themes that he lifted up during his time, but I bring it into our times and address those issues that are so perplexing in our society, racism, the death penalty, the incredible mission of the church, the disaffected youth in our society, our thirst for violence, gun control, teenage pregnancy, youth and nonviolence, just so many issues, and our racial climate as well. I address those in my book.
How old were you when your father died?
I was 5 years of age when he died. I just turned 5 years.
Do you remember listening to him preach?
No, I don't remember listening to him preach. Most of the listening that I did was through tapes and film strips that I watched.
What do you say to those who are for the death penalty, who are the families of murder victims and who feel it's the only way to get closure, an eye for an eye?
Well, the fact of the matter is you can't close out anger and pain by killing off another human being. The only way you can close that off is coming face to face with that anger and pain and releasing it and finding a constructive way to begin to live your life, perhaps in a cause against violence and crime that would lead people to kill the loved ones, that were part of your family. I understand that the people who perpetrate such violent crimes in most instances are people who are sick. They have been influenced by an evil spirit. Some of them have been frustrated by terrible social and economic circumstances in our society. And so the issue is not so much their violence. The issue is the violence of American society and our neglect and abandonment of so many people in our society. You know, we throw people away, and it causes them to act in these kinds of veins. And so we have a responsibility to try to forge some kind of positive and constructive action toward ridding our society of violence so we don't have other people who become victims. Secondly, you know, anger can eat away at your body. I mean, even from a practical sense, it can lead to things such as cancer and things of that nature. So it's not healthy to harbor hate and anger. And your loved one never returns. That's the issue. The pain is going to always be there. You're never going to have that person again physically, and killing another human being will not ever change that. And it does not produce the healing that you need. The other thing is that there are so many inequities in our criminal justice system, and oftentimes we put people in the death chair who happen to be innocent, and you cannot tell me that it's okay to execute people who are guilty and end up executing one innocent person. And it's okay to have a system like that that's so flawed, because once one life is lost, that's too many to have a system that does not work 100%. It will never work 100%. And so economically, we need to be spending our monies in another way, trying to redirect and the minds and the lives of these people who could very fact in prison be transformed and begin to send some messages maybe to those outside of the prison walls and encouraging them in another kind of lifestyle, people who are just like them and who may have been led astray like them. You have to remember that in the Bible, Moses was one who killed someone and he fled, he buried the body, fled the scene, and God sent him back into his own society to redeem his own people. And so we can't just write him off and kill him off, but we have to find a way to heal the wound of everyone involved.
Let me ask you, Reverend King, if you feel resolved in the case of your father, that James Earl Ray, who's in the headlines now somewhat because he's, I guess, unconscious now, and there are questions being raised in this last minute about whether he was the killer of your father, the shooter of your father, or whether he was working with someone else. How do you feel about this?
Well, you know, I try not to spend a lot of energy focusing on that particular issue. You know, as I lift in this particular book, you know, I try to focus my energy on what as an individual, as an American citizen, what can I do? What can we do to deal with the social and economic injustices in our society? And if one of those happens to be the fact that James Earl Ray was not afforded a just trial, then we need to provide him with that. He's due that if that is the case. But I try not to energize myself in that manner and in that vein. You know, I try to lift up some of the things that I think are important in our society, as reflected in my book.
Mm-hmm. Today is the official observance of your father's birthday. New Hampshire is the only state in the country that does not officially recognize this day, despite the fact that there have been a number of activists there and more have been elected to the state legislature, and the governor, Jean Shaheen, says she wants it to be an official holiday. How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, in fact, the first sermon in my book entitled A Prophet Without Honor was delivered up in New Hampshire about 2.5-3 years ago during the King holiday celebration. And I believe, if nothing else, I was able to plant seeds in the minds of people who may have not considered the importance of having a day dedicated to the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. And I'm sure that there were those in the audience. I was even approached by some in the audience who thanked me for sharing that they never thought about it the way in which I presented it. And what I say primarily in the book is that, you know, this is a man who represents primarily the best of America, the things that we care about and the things that we are concerned about as American citizens. The liberty, the freedom, and the justice and equality for all people. And if nothing else, we need to have a day set aside to represent that in American society. And the man who perhaps represented it the best is Martin Luther King Jr. And to keep the integrity of his message alive, it's important that we do ascribe it to his name, as opposed to calling it just a community service day, because it loses its true essence when we do that. And it causes us to kind of escape the fact that we do have to face the hard issues in our society. And this is what I say in my book, you know, they're hard issues, but they're hard answers. And we have to face those issues, whether we like it or not. And he helped us to face them the best. And we can never forget the climate that we've come from and that we continue to live in. And so it's important to have this day to improve race relations, to improve economic conditions for all people, and to look at what kind of ways we can rid our society of the level of violence that we've been experiencing.
Today, President Clinton will be inaugurated for his second term, and this inauguration, unusually enough, happens to fall on this federal observance of your father's birthday. What would you like to hear the president say? Because in a sense, he's going to be giving a sermon too today.
Yes, you know, what's most important, and it's a message that I try to give, and it's certainly a message that I hope that people get from this book, is that he gives a message of hope to the people of America. That's what Martin King was about. The I Have a Dream speech really was a message of hope. It was not a message to say that we had achieved that or that we would achieve it tomorrow or the next day, but it was a message to say that at some point, our end result and our goal ought to be that. And then it propels us to begin to work on those things that are against that. And I just hope that President Clinton, and knowing him the way that I know him as an American citizen and respect him, he will do that. He has an incredible sense of passion for American society, for social and economic injustice, and I'm sure he is going to lift up those points of hope that my father lifted up, the fact that we can make this a better America, you know, we will make it a better America, and we're going to forge ahead and address, you know, kind of taken from my book, the hard questions of our times and begin to allow the hard answers to come forward.
Reverend Bernice King is Martin Luther King Jr.'s youngest daughter. She's written a book called Hard Questions, Hard Answers. His oldest son, Martin Luther King, has just formed a national organization to say that he is going to fight any affirmative action rollbacks around the country. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, the Gingrich ethics hearings. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Late Friday, the House Ethics Committee finally held the long-awaited and much-delayed public hearings into the ethics violations of House Speaker Newt Gingrich. The Republican chair of the committee, Nancy Johnson, managed to defy parliamentary procedure and unilaterally cancel the original 5 days of hearings and managed to bury the one day of hearing on the Friday afternoon of inaugural weekend. Today, we bring you highlights of those hearings and then commentary from Jeffrey Klein, the editor of Mother Jones Magazine, who's followed Speaker Gingrich for years. We begin with Connecticut Republican Nancy Johnson, chair of the Ethics Committee, who called the hearings to order.
We are here today to provide full and complete public disclosure to Congress and the American people of the facts in the case against Representative Gingrich. Today, copies of the committee's report were sent to all 435 members of the House of Representatives and made available to the public. This afternoon, the committee will conduct a hearing on the appropriate penalty for violation of House rules by Representative Gingrich. The penalty recommendation the committee will consider is tough and unprecedented compared to past cases. The committee's decision will be guided by its belief that the Speaker of the House must be held to the highest ethical standards. No one is above the rules of the House. This investigation began on December 5, 1995, when the committee voted to establish a subcommittee and to appoint a special counsel to investigate the allegations that Mr. Gingrich was using nonprofit educational organizations for improper political purposes. On December 21, 1996, the subcommittee adopted a statement of alleged violation in which it found that Representative Gingrich violated House Rule 43, Clause 1, which requires a member to conduct himself at all times in a manner which shall reflect credibly on the House of Representatives. The subcommittee based the alleged violation on its determination that Mr. Gingrich failed to seek and follow legal advice regarding the use of tax-exempt organizations, that he did not take appropriate steps to ensure that those tax-exempt entities acted in accordance with Section 501(c)(3) of the Internal Revenue Code. And the subcommittee also found that Mr. Gingrich and his representative provided information to the committee that Mr. Gingrich should have known was inaccurate, incomplete, and unreliable. Mr. Gingrich admitted to the charges. He also waived his right to a disciplinary hearing. Mr. Gingrich's admission and the full committee's acceptance of his request to waive his right to a disciplinary hearing means that this hearing is not about Mr. Gingrich's guilt or innocence. Mr. Cole's lengthy final report, which the committee has released, provides a detailed explanation of the committee's finding and the basis for the charges against Mr. Gingrich. Rather, the purpose of this hearing is to determine what penalty to impose on Mr. Gingrich. The chair recognizes that because no disciplinary hearing occurred, it is important to provide complete information to the American people about the facts of this important case.
The Republican Ethics Chair, Nancy Johnson, was followed by Maryland Democrat Benjamin Cardin. Cardin is the leading Democrat on the committee and has replaced Jim McDermott, who recused himself from the committee because of the flap over the cellular phone tapes of Newt Gingrich's conversations. Democrat Ben Cardin.
Today is a sad day. A member has admitted violating the ethics rules of our House and bringing discredit on the House of Representatives. This process and this admission affects not only that member, but affects each of us who serve in this body. While I believe this is true in any ethics proceedings, it's particularly true and particularly troublesome in this case because the offending member is the Speaker of the House, the third-ranking official in our government. It is never a pleasant matter to sit in judgment on the ethical transgressions of a colleague, but it must be done, and the reputation and honor of the House depend on our willingness to do this conscientiously. In fact, it's our solemn constitutional responsibility. We are charged with the duty to judge the qualifications of the members of the House. I am determined to do my part to see that the committee discharges its duty in a way that reflects credit on the House of Representatives. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Maryland Democrat Benjamin Cardin was followed by Special Counsel James M. Cole. Cole had just released his report the day before on Thursday. Here he lays out the case against Speaker Newt Gingrich.
The subcommittee found that in regard to two separate projects, Mr. Gingrich engaged in activity that was involving 501(c)(3) organizations that was substantially motivated by partisan political goals. The subcommittee also found that Mr. Gingrich had provided the committee with material information about one of those projects that was inaccurate, incomplete, and unreliable. The first project was a television program called the American Opportunities Workshop. It is many times referred to as AOW. It took place in May of 1990, and the idea for this project came from Mr. Gingrich, and he was principally responsible for developing the message that was to be broadcast through this program. AOW involved broadcasting a television program on subjects concerning governmental issues. Mr. Gingrich had hoped that by using this program, he would be able to create a citizens' movement. And in doing this, workshops were set up throughout the country where people could gather and watch the program and where people could be recruited for this citizens' movement. While the program was educational, the citizens' movement was also considered to be a tool to recruit non-voters and people who were apolitical to the Republican Party. The message that was used in AOW was considered to be one that would be particularly useful for Republicans and that could not be used for Democrats. The program, however, was deliberately free of any references to Republicans or any partisan politics because Mr. Gingrich believed that such references would dissuade the target audience of the program, that being non-voters, from becoming involved. AOW started off as a project of GOPAC. GOPAC is a political action committee which is dedicated to, among other things, achieving Republican control of the United States Congress. The methods GOPAC uses to achieve this goal include developing and articulating a political message and disseminating that message as widely as possible. One avenue of dissemination for GOPAC's message was AOW. The program, however, consumed a great deal of GOPAC's resources. Because of this, Mr. Gingrich and others at GOPAC decided to transfer the American Opportunities Workshop to a 501c3 organization in order to attract tax-deductible funding. The organization that was chosen was called the Abraham Lincoln Opportunity Foundation. It is referred to as ALOF. At the time that the organization was used, it had been dormant. It had been formed years earlier by Mr. Calloway, and its activities had ceased for a number of years. It was revived in order to take over the AOW project and was using offices at GOPAC, using staff from GOPAC, and using GOPAC's facilities. The program, when it moved to the Abraham Lincoln Opportunities Foundation, was known as American Citizens Television. It had the same educational aspects as the American Opportunities Workshop, and it had the same partisan political goals. The principal difference between the two was that ACTV, as it is known, used approximately $260,000 in tax-deductible contribution to fund its operations. ACTV broadcast three programs in 1990 and then ceased its operations. The last program was funded by an organization other than ALOF in the main, an organization that was chartered under 501c4 because the program was deemed to be too political for a 501c3 organization. The second project utilizing 501c3 organizations that Mr. Gingrich was involved in encompassed a college course that he taught, which was called Renewing American Civilization. Mr. Gingrich developed the course as a subset of and a tool of a larger political and cultural movement, which was also known as Renewing American Civilization. The goal of this movement, as stated by Mr. Gingrich, was the replacement of the welfare state with an opportunity society. A primary means of achieving this goal was the development of a message for the movement and a dissemination of that message as widely as possible. Mr. Gingrich intended that a Republican majority would be a heart of the movement and that the movement would professionalize the House Republicans. The methods that were described for achieving this included using the message of the movement to attract voters, resources, and candidates to the Republican Party. According to Mr. Gingrich, in the course of his interviews with the subcommittee and with me, the course was, among other things, a primary and essential means for developing and disseminating this message. The core message of the movement and the course was that the welfare state had failed, that it could not be repaired, that it had to be replaced, and that it had to be replaced with an opportunity society based on what Mr. Gingrich called the five pillars of American civilization. There was also a concentration on three areas of public policy. The same message that was used for the movement was also the same message used as Mr. Gingrich's campaign theme in 1993 and 1994. And Mr. Gingrich sought to have Republican candidates adopt the message as well in their campaigns. In the context of political campaigns, Mr. Gingrich told the subcommittee that the term welfare state was used as a negative label for Democrats and that the term opportunity society was used as a positive label for Republicans. As general chairman of GOPAC during this period of time, Mr. Gingrich had decided that GOPAC would use the Renewing American Civilization message as its political message and as its theme during 1993 and 1994. GOPAC, however, was having financial difficulties at this time. It could not afford to disseminate its political messages as it had in the past, and it looked for other ways in which to do this. GOPAC had a number of roles in regard to the course. For example, GOPAC personnel helped to develop, manage, promote, and raise funds for the course. GOPAC charter members helped develop the idea to even teach the course. And GOPAC charter members, at one of its charter meetings, developed some of the messages that would be used in the course and used for GOPAC. According to Mr. Gingrich, GOPAC was better off as a result of the nationwide dissemination of the Renewing American Civilization message that was done by the course, because the course disseminated the message of the movement and of GOPAC without cost to GOPAC. The course itself was taught at Kennesaw State College in 1993 and at Reinhardt College in 1994 and 1995. Each year, the course consisted of 10 lectures, and each lecture consisted of 4 hours of classroom instruction. Mr. Gingrich taught half of the lecture, 2 hours each week, and a co-professor, a professor from the college that it was at, taught the other 2 hours. Students from each of the college, as well as people who were not students, would attend the lectures. Only Mr. Gingrich's portion of the lectures, his 20 hours, were disseminated via cable, television, satellite broadcasts, videotapes, audio tapes, through the Renewing American Civilization Project. The 20 hours of lecture of the co-professors were not disseminated and were not distributed. As with the American Opportunities Workshop and the American Citizens Television Project, the Renewing American Civilization Project and course involved setting up workshops around the country where people would gather to watch the course. While the course was indeed educational, Mr. Gingrich intended that the workshops would be, among other things, a recruiting tool for GOPAC and for the Republican Party. The major costs for Renewing American Civilization as a course were for the dissemination of the lectures. There was very little money needed to be spent to actually put the course on itself. This expense of dissemination of the message and of the lectures was paid for by tax-deductible contributions that were made to various 501c3 organizations that sponsored the course. Over the 3 years that the course was broadcast, approximately $1.2 million was spent on this project. The Kennesaw State College Foundation sponsored the course the first year. All the funds raised were turned over to that foundation and dedicated exclusively for the use of the Renewing American Civilization course. The foundation did not, however, manage the course, and its role was limited to that of a bank. It would take in the money, put it in its bank account, and when presented with bills that were approved, would pay those bills. The management of the course was contracted to another organization called the Washington Policy Group. This was a private corporation set up by Jeffrey Eisenach, who was at the time GOPAC's executive director. Mr. Eisenach resigned from GOPAC on June 1st of 1993 to take over the operation and management of the course through the Washington Policy Group. Mr. Eisenach, in fact, played a similar role through the Washington Policy Group with American Opportunities Workshop and American Citizens Television. In fact, when Mr. Eisenach wrote to the Kennesaw State College Foundation to propose a contract for his company to manage the Renewing American Civilization course, in the letter he states that that project was indeed very similar to the American Opportunities Workshop and the American Citizens Television project. As such, he had very much experience in this field and knew about all the aspects and problems that would be presented when he took on the Renewing American Civilization project. Following the Washington Policy Group's management of the course, a new 501c3 organization became involved. That was known as the Progress and Freedom Foundation. This was also a creation of Mr. Eisenach's. He was its founder, he was its president, and the organization took over the management of the course after Washington Policy Group.
You're listening to Special Counsel James M. Cole, who's laying out the case against Speaker Newt Gingrich in those long-delayed hearings that took place last Friday night. We're going to go back to just the end of his laying out the case, and then we'll be joined by Jeffrey Klein, editor of Mother Jones Magazine, to put this all in context. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and we rejoin Special Counsel James N. Cole as he continues to lay out the case against Newt Gingrich. Here he's talking about the course he taught that was forced out of Kennesaw College in Georgia and went over to Reinhardt College.
The course moved to Reinhardt College because of some controversy that arose while it was at Kennesaw State. There had been some complaints by people, faculty members, primarily at Kennesaw State College, that the course was being used to disseminate a political message. Following these complaints, and during the first year of the course being taught at Kennesaw State College, the Board of Regents made a decision that elected public officials could not teach at state schools. Because of this, it was decided that the course would be moved to a private, non-state school. The course was moved to Reinhardt College. It stayed there for 1994's winter quarter and 1995's winter quarter. While at Reinhardt, the Progress and Freedom Foundation assumed full responsibility for the course. Instead of receiving payments in a contract sense, the Progress and Freedom Foundation handled the fundraising, took in all the money, and paid all the bills. The only role for Reinhardt College was to rent its television production facilities to the Progress and Freedom Foundation for the course and to provide the site for the course to be presented and a faculty member. In reviewing the course prior to taking on its role with it, Reinhardt College appreciated the fact that there were really two things going on with the course. One was a college course, and that they wanted to have taught at its institution. But the other was what it perceived to be a political project. This involved the dissemination of the course. As a result, Reinhardt College made it clear to Mr. Eisenach that they would only be involved in the course itself. Any of the fundraising, any of the dissemination, any of the things that it viewed as being part of the political project, it would not be involved in.
Special Counsel James M. Cole laying out the case against House Speaker Newt Gingrich. You're listening to Democracy Now! As we turn to Jeffrey Klein, who is in Berkeley at our Berkeley studios, KPFA. Jeffrey Klein is the editor of Mother Jones Magazine and has been following Newt Gingrich for far longer than the House Ethics Committee has been. Again, these are just excerpts you're listening to. Tomorrow, we will play more of the interaction between the Republicans and the Democrats on the House Ethics Committee as they battled out, not quite battled out, since they've basically agreed to the reprimand that they've basically agreed to the sanction against Newt Gingrich. They have decided, they have voted 7-1, with one person going against this vote, the new member of the committee, Lamar Smith. He's a Republican, very much an ally of Newt Gingrich. They voted 7-1 to reprimand the Speaker. This is to recommend reprimand to the full House and to fine him $300,000, although the term fine is in dispute. The $300,000 is not. And both of these, the reprimand and the $300,000, were negotiated with Newt Gingrich's lawyer, so he has agreed to them. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeffrey Klein.
Good morning.
Well, we watched those hearings together on Friday night. Why don't you lay out the circumstances around these very long-delayed and much-shortened hearings?
Well, the Republicans' one on procedure was basically orchestrated by Newt. It didn't happen in prime time. Only C-SPAN and Pacifica covered it. Nancy Johnson essentially did what Newt wanted, and documents were released over the weekend showing that this was devised by Joe Gaylord, Newt's chief political advisor. And their assumption was that if it didn't occur in primetime TV, it didn't occur. They took a beating over the weekend, of course, in the newspapers, but they postponed it to the last possible minute. And you can see why, because the hearings, I thought, were great moments in democracy. They were very sober. They were analytic. I think the logic that Cole proceeded under was inexorable. You had to see that this speaker was guilty of repeated patterns of misbehavior even after the penalty phase. And it was just many, many years of crime, lying. Then we went into the second phase of the hearings, which were Newt's plea bargain of the plea bargain, and I thought it was rather pathetic. And the Democrats sort of said why they had settled, because they didn't want 6 months of trial. But I thought it was very, very impressive, both on the political theater level and the moral seriousness, and that's what we took part in on Friday. But I think the Republicans' strategy is proving to be right based on what I've seen over the weekend. Gephardt held a meeting of all the Democrats, and he said, we're going to approve this penalty, and then we're going to move on. And then the Republicans basically over the weekend, they were low-key, but they got their talking points out. And you can see their strategy coming up, which is basically, this was a double standard applied to Newt. People who did the same level of crime before didn't get this level of penalty. They're trying to lure the Democrats into discussion as a tax issue rather than a moral issue. They're putting out little bipartisan figs. They're not figlies. They are figlies, but they're offering a few things to the Democrats, and the Democrats are taking it. I think if you analyze what was available to the Democrats and what they've not taken, it's really fairly amazing. And it shows you the void that Newt moved into in his whole political career. And let me put it this way. The Republicans have taken the ground as being anti-statist. And they are going to use Newt's case, even the $300,000 penalty, as this is why we need to revise trial law so that loser pays. And Newt, the brave Newt, is going to be the first one to pave the way by being the loser in paying, and he's proud about that. And then the second thing that he said over the weekend at the RNC convention is he's moved on from his number one excuse, which was he was renewing American civilization because he was inspired by himself. Now he's admitting he was inspired by God, and he's going to help Americans find God. So he's moved into the religious argument. And what was available to the Democrats, which they haven't taken, is a very, very powerful American narrative. You've seen it in every American political film and play, particularly in Born Yesterday, in which no one's above the law, and we all have to respond to our moral conscience. And Cardin and Pelosi laid this out in the hearing. Actually, all the Democrats did, that it's particularly busy people that have to adhere to their conscience, and particularly in murky areas, not in clear ones. And the Democrats have dropped that argument. That is, we would be an anarchic nation unless individuals behaved in a moral way. And that's why the moral behavior of this speaker is not only unbecoming to the country, it's dangerous. And we can't have this dangerous person as our third highest constitutional officer. And they're not talking this way. They're talking in a kind of whiny way about tax law, and they're saying, let's move on and be friends.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Democratic Congress member Tom Sawyer on the House Ethics Committee did make that point, although we're not hearing that right. And we're going to play that tomorrow because we're going to continue this for 3 days. Today we played excerpts. Tomorrow we'll play the responses back and forth of the Republicans and Democrats. And then tomorrow in the daytime, there's going to be an hour debate on the House floor, at least at this point it's planned. You know, who knows? Nancy Johnson may manage to cancel that as well. But an hour debate between the Democrats and the Republicans on how to sanction Newt Gingrich, although he's already agreed to this sanction, the reprimand and the $300,000, and then they'll vote. And we'll play excerpts of that debate on Wednesday morning's Democracy Now! But I wanted to ask you about John Boehner's comments. John Boehner, the Republican House leader, who has been very much doing Newt Gingrich's bidding, defending him. But yesterday he said that Newt Gingrich should pay from personal rather than campaign funds the $300,000 penalty. That's part of the sanction he's agreed to. Now, this is interesting. Boehner is chair of the House Republican Conference, and he said if Gingrich taps into his campaign fund to pay the penalty, it's going to cause another uproar. Gingrich has, I think, about $1 million in his campaign fund. What do you think about that? So Boehner's slightly singing a different tune here.
Well, I think Newt would be really foolish to keep the controversy alive, and so he probably should pay out of his personal funds. I mean, he's going to be replenished. The level at which he lives and functions, $300,000 is not a lot of money. It's just a question whether his compulsive behavior will force him to rationalize that he did nothing wrong. But they're very smart, the Republicans. They're very cohesive. So I think they'll get this issue out of the news. And meanwhile, Newt's on notice from his fellow Republicans, particularly the moderates, that we're on very thin ice here. Don't make this go on longer than it already has. And but they talk all the time, not on cell phones anymore, but they talk all the phones all the time. So I think they'll handle this.
Well, it's interesting what else is happening. Right now, it's not only Jim McDermott, the congressmember from Washington, who is the leading Democrat on the House Ethics Committee until he recused himself because of the controversy over the tape he received of Newt Gingrich discussing strategies about the probe. And then, well, it's not clear, but someone leaked that to the New York Times. They're not only talking about going after Jim McDermott. They're talking about going after Congressmember Boehner as well, the minority whip. And they're saying that with this loser pays approach that Newt Gingrich will begin with, they're talking about, Tom DeLay talked about this, a Republican from Texas, that Boehner and others might be asked to pay for some of the more than 70 charges against Gingrich that were dismissed.
Yeah, that's a very interesting piece of misinformation that the Democrats haven't countered in any significant way. I mean, Pelosi again talked about it in the hearings. Gingrich has been reproved many, many times, and many of these charges have been proved accurate. I mean, he had to change the whole way he got the book advance. He had that guy make telecommunications deal out of his office into New Zealand and profit from it. He did commercials on the House floor. So this whole, this is the only one, is just complete lie. And the Democrats don't have their act together to say, hold on a second, there's seven of these things. This is a pattern of misbehavior, a pattern of lying. So it, and besides, there's a second aspect to that delay comment to Bonnier, which is they're trying to isolate Bonnier. They don't want a guy who's for 2 years pressed charges that have turned out to be deeply true to in any way feel satisfied. So they're trying to pull him out of the pack. And the Democrats are not standing behind him. The Democrats are privately giving Bonnier advice. You know, you better develop a broader portfolio. Enough of your anti-Newt stuff. Let's back off this. So internally, it's very bad what the Democrats are doing.
Jeffrey, didn't and Benjamin Cardin release at the time of the hearings a letter that they got a hold of that was a memo from the Republicans that laid out that Bonnier and others should be gone after? It sort of was the print version of the conversation, that illegal conversation that was taped, or the conversation
exactly.
that was illegally taped, which talked about also going after the wives of the Congress members.
Absolutely, and they've done Gephardt in a mild way, and that's why they've gotten him to buy in because of his vacation home problems. And then they also said, as I said at the outset in that memo that Cardin's released, that they wanted to delay the special counsel as long as possible. I mean, here's a team whose strategy has been completely released, and yet the opposing team can't do anything about it. It shows you what dinosaurs the Democrats are. They haven't recovered from their loss more than 2 years ago. They're still in an era of markups and sub-markups and committees, and they've lost all moral ground. They don't know how to make the moral argument to Americans anymore. And they're going to suffer. They're going to repeatedly suffer until new leadership comes forward, until Gephardt's ousted.
This very much reminds me of Tom Foley when he was House Speaker, when it was clear that the Democrats could, and they were in charge, could go after the president around Iran-Contra. Tom Foley said, we're not going to destabilize the presidency.
Yeah, exactly. And Foley never thought he would come close to losing. Matter of fact, we ran an expose prior to Newt's, and where we're going to run Clinton subsequent to Newt's, but our first expose was on Foley, how he went around to the freshman reform class 2 years ago and said, hey, listen, if you pursue this as an issue, you're not going to have big committee openings. You're not going to get anything. Reform is not a big issue whatsoever. And the Democrats continue to feel this way, and I think they'll continue to shrivel as a party as a result.
Well, Jeffrey Klein, today is the inauguration of President Clinton, and it's the 53rd presidential inauguration.
Mm-hmm.
And I would expect that no one more than President Clinton wants this to go away, since he's up next in the hot seat with the hearings that will be held by Republican Senator Fred Thompson, expected to be the beginning of March, to go into his campaign finances. So would you say that there's also pressure coming from the White House to not only put an end to this because they don't want the same kind of pressure on them, but because a weakened Newt Gingrich, President Clinton feels more comfortable with?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Clinton checked in last week and said he wanted the whole thing to go away. I have found him pressuring, but more importantly, he's shown a complete lack of leadership. And Fred Thompson, now that I mentioned Born Yesterday, was in that remake of a couple years ago. And the Fred Thompson hearings aren't going to be happening on Friday night, I can assure you. They're going to be well lit, and they're going to be in prime time, and they're going to play to the moral issues. There's one similarity in that the Republicans really don't want to get rid of Clinton either, especially this early. They want a weakened President Clinton. They don't want to clear him out and have Gore there in the same way the Democrats don't want to clear Newt out. And so you really have, as I said when we were talking Friday, you have bipartisan corruption. And you can't have a bipartisan solution to bipartisan corruption. All you can have is bipartisan fig leaves. You need nonpartisan solutions to this, which is a very, very serious assault on democracy, which is the control of money over politics and the control of politics over government. So we're really lacking connection to our representatives.
And using that flora metaphor, we're not only talking about fig leaves, but we're talking about the need for grassroots action. Jeffrey Klein, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Jeffrey Klein is editor of Mother Jones Magazine, been following Newt Gingrich for many years. You're listening to Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin and Errol Maitland, our executive producer, Julie Drizin, our engineer, Kenneth Mason. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And as we go out today on this 53rd inauguration, presidential inauguration, we're also going out on the official holiday of Martin Luther King's birthday.
Let us turn our thoughts today to Martin Luther King and recognize that there are ties between us, all men and women living on the earth. Ties of hope and love, of sister and brotherhood, that we are bound.